From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps, in for Jim Fleming. Stephen Hawking once said that if we could understand the origins of the universe, we would know the mind of God. Now he says he's changed his mind. We no longer need God to make sense of the universe because we've got science. And especially quantum physics, that famously weird, mind-bending science full of uncertainty and entanglement.
It's basically incomprehensible. I mean, what does it mean that light is both a particle and a wave? Or what does it mean that particles can influence each other from a distance? It's mind-boggling, right?
In this hour, what it means to live in a quantum universe and how scientists trying to figure out the nature of time and space accidentally paved the way for cell phones and laptops and all that other good stuff.
Schrödinger is not trying to invent a CD player, but without the efforts of him and Heisenberg and Bohr and a handful of other scientists, the world we live in would be profoundly different.
Also, what's really at stake when scientists grapple with the ultimate questions? It's not all black holes and CD players, is it?
What is the nature of reality? How rich, how many-layered, how many-dimensional is the world of reality in which we live?
Exploring the quantum universe today. First, Stephen Hawking is the most famous physicist alive today. So famous, he's inspired books and films and even songs. The music we're listening to, in fact, is from a jazz CD called Good Night, Stephen Hawking. Still, it's a little startling that his new book, The Grand Design, has generated protests and headlines around the world. Religious leaders in the UK and the US are bothered by Hawking's claim that he's figured out where the universe came from, and the answer is not from God. Steve Paulson sat down with Hawking's co-author, Caltech physicist Leonard Mlodinow, to talk about the book and its public reception.
Why do you think this book has struck such a nerve?
Well, it's the comments that we make about God and that it's coming from Stephen Hawking. But it's not really the comments we make about God. You see, the book is about two things at its basic level. One is, where did the universe come from or how was it created? And the other is, why are the laws of nature what they are? And the second question, we should understand that when I say how are they what they are, that they seem to be extremely finely tuned in a manner that allows our existence. That is, if you change them by even a small amount, in many cases, the universe will not look the way it does today, and it will have evolved differently in a way that doesn't allow for intelligent life. And these questions, in one form or another, have been asked throughout the ages. People have always wondered, how did the universe get here? And people have always wondered, you know, why is our world so hospitable? They might not have known quite how finely tuned the laws are that, for instance, you can't change the proton mass more than 2 parts in 1,000 without destroying everything. But they wondered, you know, they looked at a horse and they said, gee, it's so comfortable to sit on. God must have put it there for that reason. People didn't have the answers to the question, so they turned to God. Modern science can answer those questions, and God, therefore, is not necessary to create the universe or to explain the laws or why they're so finely tuned.
Well, your book certainly has generated quite a lot of pushback from religious leaders. For instance, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, has said, and I'm quoting here, "Physics on its own will not settle the question of why there is something rather than nothing." Is he wrong?
Well, physics offers an answer, a scientific answer to why there is something rather than nothing. If that doesn't satisfy you, if in your own mind you're looking for a different kind of answer, then we don't say that you can't find a different answer. We don't say God didn't create the universe or that it's wrong to believe that. We're saying science offers an answer, and it's the answer, a scientific type of answer. Science is based on observation and testing. Science is why we have the radio and all the other conveniences of modern life. It actually leads to something, and it's verifiable. It has tangible results. But then there's also the spiritual world, the world of thought, and if people wish to believe that there's something else beyond that, then we have nothing to say about that. We certainly wouldn't oppose that in the way that they oppose our saying that science also has an answer.
Mm-hmm. Let me follow up on the statement that you and Hawking make at the very beginning of your book, that the universe can and will create itself from nothing. This is the thing that, you know, for generations people thought, you know, you needed God for. You're saying that you can explain the spontaneous creation scientifically. How do you do that?
There are several elements in that explanation, but the one concept that's really very relevant to that, immediately relevant, is the concept of nothingness. So in quantum theory, nothingness does not exist in the way you think of it, as that there's nothing there. From nothingness, things are constantly fluctuating in and out of existence. When you apply these ideas to the whole universe, you find that multiple universes appear from nothing, each with their own physical laws, their own different laws of nature, and that they appear spontaneously. And that's, I think, what is exciting people who would like to think that God created the universe instead. But anyway, that's a thumbnail explanation.
Well, I have to ask about Stephen Hawking's 1988 book, A Brief History of Time, which, of course, was an enormous bestseller. And he ends that book with a statement, if we discover a complete theory, it would be the ultimate triumph of human reason, for then we should know the mind of God. Is it fair to say that Hawking is no longer interested in the mind of God?
Well, I think that physicists often speak of God in a metaphorical way. And, you know, at most what they mean when they talk that way quite often is some other, not necessarily the specific God of the Bible or the Quran or any particular God, but God as the embodiment of physical law, the way Einstein talked about God. Now, I'm not saying that Stephen was talking that way, but since you bring that up, I think that, you know, he's saying that if this was true, we would know the grand design is what he's saying. And he's saying, you know, what is the grand design? And in the last 20-some years since that book was written, actually, it started in the early 80s, so it's been 25 years, his thinking has evolved. And in the new book, we explain why the laws of nature are what they are, and we talk about the many histories, multiple histories of the universe existing simultaneously. And I think we go to a more definitive statement that that God isn't necessary for these answers.
Mm-hmm. Let me follow up on this idea of multiple universes, or what's sometimes called the multiverse. Other people have talked about parallel universes. I know there are sort of different ways that these theories can play out. Are you saying there are many different versions, perhaps infinite numbers of versions of me roaming around in different universes, each split off in different quantum realities?
Not quite. There are infinitely many different universes. The universe exists in many different guises or many different superposition of different histories. That's what you get from applying quantum theory to the universe. But of course, you have been observed, you have been measured. So a universe where you have four arms is not a possibility. That can be eliminated from the fact that we know that you have two arms. So the measurements and the observations that occur, the interactions that occur in the present, prune out of all these histories which ones are possible, and they define that final point.
So you're not saying, for instance, that if I made a different choice, I don't know, 20-some years ago and, you know, didn't marry my wife and have the two children that I have now, that I'd be living in a different reality and I might have, I don't know, four children with a different wife. I mean, you're not sort of laying out that as a conceivable scenario that, you know, this other me might exist in a different universe. That's not what you're talking about.
No, that's a separate issue from the multiverse issue. And the multiverse issue says that when the universe was formed, many universes were formed, and, you know, all with different laws. Some of them were very different than ours, and some of them were very similar to ours. So, you know, one could speculate, if one wanted to take this slightly into the speculative or science fiction realm, that this means that other universes exist where what you said is true and you're made different life choices. And
there are people, you know, physicists who've made that argument. I mean, that's sort of the parallel universe.
Well, no, I think you're talking about the many worlds interpretation of quantum theory, which is a slightly different topic. We can go into that if you want.
No, that's okay.
Well,
you know, I want to step back for a moment and ask about your collaboration with Stephen Hawking, who is such a distinctive figure in the world, arguably the most famous scientist since Einstein. And of course, he suffers from neuromuscular dystrophy, which has left him almost completely paralyzed. How did you write this book with him?
Well, we had basically two means. One is together and the other is apart. He comes out to Caltech about 4 to 6 weeks every year. And we would, in that period, we would work intensely together.
Do you mainly talk with each other? Do you communicate in other ways?
Yeah, we talk to each other. I mean, of course, he communicates differently, but we would, you know, have the read over the page and talk, and sometimes engage in chit chat or jokes, or, you know, over dinner, you know, watch TV or whatever, and then talk. You know, yeah, just like any two people would. And in between, we would each have our own little assignments, and we would email them back and forth, and pretty much each rewriting each other, and, you know, debating the ideas, the way we say things, even in some cases, single words. I mean, that's why it took 4 years.
Well, the reason I ask is, yeah, I have this image of Stephen Hawking as a man who's whose physical ability to communicate is very slow, but whose mind is racing at warp speed. Is that a fair description?
Yes, it is. The one advantage from my point of view, he says it's his disability is an advantage because it allows him to focus. And I'm telling you that from my point of view, the advantage is it allows me to keep up with him.
So. Did you argue over passages in the book?
Sometimes we did. The most interesting one was a passage that we're arguing over. He's telling me I'm wrong, and I'm sure that I'm right. And after about an hour, he's answering me, and I'm getting frustrated. I'm looking at my laptop to see, well, you know, what's the origin of this? How could I have misunderstood? And I find that he's the one who originally wrote the passage. So I said, Stephen, I hold up my computer to him to see. I said, you wrote this. He says, it's still wrong. And I look at him, and then the next thing he says is, I changed my mind. This is at the beginning, this was his top-down cosmology, which we didn't talk about in this interview, but it's a major element of the book, and he was still developing it. So that's what that was all about. But it was an interesting discussion. So he pulled the trump card and said that that he was wrong. So now look at it this way, you know.
Leonard Mlodinow is a physicist at Caltech and author of The Drunkard's Walk. He and Steve were talking about The Grand Design, co-authored by Mlodinow and Stephen Hawking. Later this hour, a particle physicist makes the case for God. But first, the line between science and fiction can get a little blurry when you're talking about quantum theory, multiple universes that appear and disappear spontaneously out of nothing. Well, just to be clear, that multiverse theory is science. This, on the other hand, is fiction.
When it happens, this is what happens. I shoot myself. Not, you know, my self-self. I shoot my future self. He steps out of a time machine, introduces himself as Charles Yu. What else am I supposed to do? I kill him. I kill my own future.
That's the opening of Charles Yu's critically acclaimed new novel, How to Live Safely in a Science Fictional Universe. Charles Yu is one of the National Book Foundation's 5 Under 35 award winners. His debut novel takes place in Minor Universe 31, a vast story space on the outskirts of fiction where paradox fluctuates like the stock market and time travel is just another business. The plot? Well, it's a little hard to describe.
It's a book about a time machine repairman who has been working and living inside of his time machine, and in the process of the story gets caught into a time loop where he goes back through his own memories and childhood with his parents growing up and has to figure out how to escape the time loop. And that's not a capsule description at all. That was too long.
That was good. Well, so is the idea here that not everyone can be Luke Skywalker or Captain Kirk, that even in a science fictional universe, someone has to supply the onboard meals and process the leave reports?
Exactly. There's a part in the book where it refers to people that are in accounts receivable on the Death Star. And I think that's something that I've been interested in from the beginning of when I started writing, is the characters who are in the background, who do the necessary jobs and, you know, their stories.
What exactly does a time travel repairman do?
Well, he actually does know how to fix the machine, which, you know, is based on not so much real technology in terms of circuits, but it's based on grammar and memory and regret. It's a time machine slash literary device. But the main thing he does is talk to the person who broke their machine, because the reason they broke it was most likely that they were trying to go back and change their past. People rent time machines. They think they can change the past. Then they get there and find out causality doesn't work the way they thought it did. They get stuck. Stuck in places they didn't mean to go. In places they did mean to go. In places they shouldn't have tried to go. They get into trouble. Logical, metaphysical, etc. That's where I come in. I go and get them out. I tell people, I have a job and I have job security. I have a job because I know how to fix the cooling module on the quantum decoherence engine of the TM-31. But the reason I have job security is that people have no idea how to make themselves happy, even with a time machine. I have job security because what the customer wants, when you get right down to it, is to relive his very worst moment over and over and over again. Willing to pay a lot of money to do it, too.
I think you were a biochem major in college, right?
I was, yeah.
But so you're clearly someone who reads a lot of physics and cosmology just for fun. I mean, I noticed in the acknowledgments to the book, you include a kind of shout-out to a book called The Fabric of Reality by David Deutsch. Most people just thank their families. So what was it about this particular book that influenced you so much?
It's a physics book for sure, but it's so wide-ranging. It's about this idea of a quantum multiverse, which is one interpretation of what it means that we live in a quantum mechanical universe, is that at an uncountably large number of points in the universe, it's actually splitting off into separate universes. And all of those things exist simultaneously in this thing called the multiverse. Now, of course, this novel only takes place in one universe, but that idea is underlying the story that I tried to tell. And I should say that I was a biochem major, but I was like a B-minus biochem major. So my talent, if I have any, is in like totally misusing science for literary purposes, which probably angers scientists everywhere.
So what are some of the ideas that you love playing with that you've explored in this book?
Well, you touched on it earlier, the sort of alternate self idea is definitely one. If we're living in anything like a quantum multiverse, what would it mean for us as selves? What does it do to your sense of who you are if there are an almost infinite number of you? I like the juxtaposition of those ideas in a sense of how do we tell the stories of ourselves, our families. And because at root, this is a story about a father and son and a mother and how a family is to some degree, I think, a story you construct about, you know, while you're living it and also later. The earliest memory I have of my own dad is the two of us sitting on my bed as he reads me a book we have checked out from the local library. I am three. I don't remember what the story is or even the title of the book. What I do remember is the way I fit between his right arm and his body, and the way his neck and the underside of his chin look in the soft yellow light of my lamp, which has a cloth lampshade, light blue, covered by an alternating pattern of robots and spaceships. This is what I remember. One, the little pocket of space he creates for me. Two, how it is enough. Three, the sound of his voice. Four, the way those spaceships look, shot through from behind with light, so that every stitch in the fabric of the surface is a hole and a source, a point and an absence. Five, how the bed feels like a little spaceship itself.
In terms of that central emotional story, which is sometimes sad, but it's the heart of the book about the son searching for his lost father. Does that come from anything personal in your own life? I mean, you have a father. You are a father.
Well, I mean, I think becoming a father relatively recently, I have a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old. It certainly made me appreciate my own father in ways, and my mother, in ways that I couldn't have ever guessed. I mean, people told me, my own parents told me plenty, you know, just wait till you have kids and you'll really appreciate your parents. And that, I mean, that was, it's been a huge sort of perspective shift for me.
I know that's this cliched thing we say, you know, just wait till you become a parent. But it is the one experience we all have of the kind of quantum reality of selfhood. I guess I'm sort of thinking about ways in which we all actually have the experience of multiple selves that you write about in this science fiction-y way, but we all kind of do know what that feels like, don't you think?
Yeah, I'm going to have to steal that phrase from you. I mean, I think it's the quantum reality of parenthood is a perfect way to put it. And sometimes just sitting in a room with my children and my parents and feeling like there's some kind of timeline, you know, just looking at the three generations and going, what are we? Like, were these weird selves that some of my parents is in me, some of me is in my kids, and a lot of it is different too. And we're these kind of weird time travelers in our bodies that are moving through time together. And at some point, you know, some of us will drop off the timeline and new parts of our, I guess, lineage will pop up. And to think of that kind of family as this long, you know, unbroken line through time, you know, with some beginning and some end, I guess, it is a really strange thing. You're right. Family itself is a very sort of strange reality.
Every time there's a big new scientific paradigm, it takes a long time for it to kind of filter its way into popular consciousness. I wonder if you see yourself as part of that kind of process here, where the basic insights of quantum physics, which are hard enough to grasp with our rational minds, are kind of gradually soaking themselves into our culture and into our ways of thinking about ourselves, our families, our relationships.
You know, I think in some tiny way, I hope to be part of a generation, I guess, or a group of people that might be more preoccupied with this than certain other kinds of stories. And the thing about quantum physics, though, you're right, it's so hard to understand. I mean, even the scientists who made quantum physics into part of our physics don't even understand it. You know, I mean, they say that nobody really understands it. It's so fundamentally weird that if you really, really understand it at all, you realize that it's basically incomprehensible. I mean, what does it mean that, you know, light is both a particle and a wave? Or what does it mean that particles can influence each other from a distance? Things like quantum entanglement or the double slit experiment, where light sort of, you know, photons will be either going through a slit or not, depending on whether or not you're looking at them. It's mind-boggling, right? I mean, on the most basic level, it's...
But is it mind-boggling in a fun way? Like, do you love this, or do you just want to scratch your head and go, ah, I just don't get it?
I love it. I love it, because I'm glad I'm not a physicist, and I'm clearly not smart enough to be one, but I love feeling like we're all in this boat. Even physicists are going, what is going on? Like, what, how could this be? You know, and it allows more mystery and possibility, I think, than if things were like, oh yeah, it's just like that. You know, Newton's mechanics, that's it. There's nothing else to it. We know exactly how everything works. Now we just got to figure out a couple other details, but we pretty much have the theory of everything down already. That'd be sort of a boring universe to live in. You know, I mean, it's better that we're just totally dumbfounded.
Charles Yu won the National Book Foundation's 5 Under 35 Award. His new novel is called How to Live Safely in a Science Fictional Universe. We're exploring the science and fiction of our quantum universe in this hour. I'm Anne Strainchamps, in for Jim Fleming, and this is To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We've talked about how science can influence fiction, but it works the other way around, too. Sometimes it's fiction that inspires science. James Kekelios tracked down some astonishing but true examples in his book, The Amazing Story of Quantum Mechanics. He told Jim Fleming that without quantum physics, we wouldn't have iPods or CD players or laptops. And even more amazing, some of the pioneers of quantum mechanics were actually inspired by science fiction.
The first science fiction pulp magazine, Amazing Story, was first published in 1926. Who else published in 1926? Erwin Schrödinger, who published the Schrödinger equation then, which is considered by many to be the first key start in modern quantum mechanics. When you've got the Schrödinger equation, you eventually get an understanding of the periodic table of the elements in chemistry. You get an understanding of the properties of solids, why some materials are metals or some are insulators or some are semiconductors. Once you have quantum mechanics and understand how atoms interact with light, you can build the transistor and the laser. Once you have the transistor and the laser, it's only a matter of time before you get cell phones and iPods and DVDs and laptop computers, pretty much everything without which life is not worth living.
Really has changed the world. Now, the other thing that fascinates me about this is the conjunction, the interaction between science and pop culture that seems to have gone along regularly.
That's right. There's an amazing story that I came across. In 1909, Frederick Soddy wrote a series of popular science books. Soddy was a collaborator with Ernst Rutherford, who is credited with being the discoverer of the nucleus in the atoms. And Soddy and Rutherford were pioneers in the discovery of nuclear chemistry. Soddy writes a popular book about atomic energy and radioactivity. This book makes a big impression on a science fiction writer, H.G. Wells, who writes a science fiction novel, The World Set Free, in 1914, about atomic weapons and an atomic war across Europe that leads to total devastation. This novel has a huge impact on Leo Szilard, who in the 1930s actually conceives and is the first person to imagine a nuclear chain reaction. And Szilard wrote the letter that Einstein signed that was delivered to Franklin Delano Roosevelt that led to the development of the Manhattan Project that led to the development of atomic weapons. So you have a popular science book from the discoverer of the nucleus inspiring science fiction, which leads directly in turn to the creation of the very weapons that were feared and written about in the science fiction novel. So there is a tremendous circle there between fiction and reality.
Well, you have to love a story like that, don't you?
Yes, it's just fantastic. And it's no less amazing for being true.
Yeah. Well, and again, I love the connection between pop culture and science and the willingness of practitioners on both sides of that to look at the work the other is doing. I was amused in the story that you tell of discovering that Niels Bohr had a theory of plot development in the Western.
Right. When they would be working in Copenhagen, Bohr, the older scientist, and a lot of the junior scientists working with him, and these are the guys in the front lines in developing quantum mechanics, would sometimes go to the movies and see, you know, these old Westerns. And they were pretty much very formulaic. And he noticed that, you know, not only did the hero always have a white hat and the bad guys had a black hat, but the bad guys always drew first and yet the hero always was victorious. And Bohr actually proposed the theory that because the villain had to decide when to draw, whereas the hero only had to react and didn't have to make a decision. He would only react when he saw the villain draw his gun. He actually had an advantage and can pull his gun out faster. And some of the younger scientists disbelieved this, and they got a bunch of toy pistols, and they tested it the way any good scientist would, by experiments and observations. And they eventually confirmed that Bohr's theory held up.
Well, it does make you think that in science as well as in pop culture, sometimes accepting the impossible is the first thing you have to do.
Well, it does seem that way for sure. The thing is that quantum mechanics, for all of its weirdness, was pretty much forced on scientists at the time. There were a set of experiments that just could not be reconciled with the existing theories of nature. There were the laws of thermodynamics, and they certainly worked very well. You have heat engines, you have the Industrial Revolution that is all built upon thermodynamics. You have electromagnetism, and that leads to radio and wireless transmission, and that all seems to be correct. And yet when you combine these two inside an atom, the theories, these correct theories, seem to give nonsensical results. Nonsensical in the sense that they have no connection to what is actually measured and what is actually observed. And that was the foundation of quantum mechanics, that it was a set of observations and a set of experiments that said, well, either everything we know is wrong or there has to be a new theory. There has to be a new way of thinking about what goes on inside an atom. And that was what led the scientists to develop quantum mechanics. Schrödinger is not trying to invent a CD player. But without the efforts of him and Heisenberg and Bohr and a handful of other scientists, the world we live in would be profoundly different.
Well, speaking of quantum mechanics, I gather that we can bless the whiter whites of our laundry on quantum mechanics.
There are growing efforts in putting like nanostructure titanium dioxides into objects, making these little particles on the nanoscale adding them to materials, and they actually can enhance the colors. They can change the colors. They can make these materials. Nanostructured fibers can resist stains, resist wear and tear, don't get dirty as easily, and can be cleaned a lot quicker. There's a lot of effort in making nanostructured pharmaceuticals for drug delivery, especially cancer-treating medicines. A nanometer is a billionth of a meter and really is three atoms laid end-to-end. That's a nanometer. And so we're dealing with structures that are maybe hundreds of nanometers, but they're also working on making smaller devices. And so as scientists, we are still dining off of the efforts of these scientists back in the 1920s that developed quantum mechanics simply because they were trying to understand how atoms and light behaved. And their curiosity-driven research continues to pay dividends and improves our lives today and going forward into the future.
James Kekelios, talking with Jim Fleming about his book, The Amazing Story of Quantum Mechanics. Remember earlier this hour when we were talking about Stephen Hawking and Leonard Mlodinow's new book, The Grand Design? Well, when the book first came out, there were headlines that said things like, Hawking says creation came from nothing, not God. So does that mean you can't believe in physics and God?
Physics offers an answer, a scientific answer to why there is something rather than nothing. If that doesn't satisfy you, if in your own mind you're looking for a different kind of answer, then we don't say that God didn't create the universe or that it's wrong to believe that.
That's what Leonard Mlodinow told Steve Paulson earlier this hour. We've got a different view now from John Polkinghorne. He's a former quantum physicist, professor of mathematical physics at Cambridge University. He's also an ordained Anglican priest, canon theologian at Liverpool Cathedral in England, and is the author of many books on the subject of bridging the gap between science and religion. Steve reached him at the BBC studio in Cambridge.
Most people assume that science and theology have little in common, science being based on reason and rigorous study of the natural world, while theology deals with more ephemeral matters of the spirit and a leap of faith into mystery. You don't accept that dichotomy, do you?
No, I don't. I think both science and theology are concerned with the search for truth and for understanding. Of course, they're looking for different kinds of truth and different levels of understanding. Science is studying the physical world as an object, really, something that you can tear apart, kick around, find out how it behaves, put it to the experimental test. Theology is concerned with the encounter with the transcendent reality of God. You can't put God to the test in that sort of way. It isn't a question that science is all fact and religion is all opinion. In both of them, there's an intertwining of interpretation and experience, fact and opinion, if you like, which I think is the way that one finds truthful understanding.
But can't scientific truth be proven? I mean, through reductive reasoning, through repeatable experiments and observation, whereas it would seem that religious truth can never be proven.
Well, I think if you look at the way science actually works, particularly if you look at very deep and important parts of science, it isn't quite as straightforward as that. For example, I worked in quantum physics all my professional life as a physicist, and we cannot prove either that quantum theory is deterministic or indeterministic. I mean, we know how to do the sums, and the sums come out extraordinarily well. I mean, it's a brilliantly successful theory at that point of view. But what does it all mean? What is actually happening? You see, I think that one of the key underlying issues between science and religion is the question of what is the nature of reality? How rich, how many layered, how many dimensional is the world of reality in which we live? Materialists tend to think that the real dimensions of reality are simply the material dimensions of reality, the sort of things that physics itself is able to describe. I think that there are many other dimensions of reality that we need to take absolutely seriously. There is, for example, mathematical truth. Most mathematicians are sure that what they're engaged in is discovery, not construction. They're not just making up amazing difficult problems, they are actually exploring a world of mathematical reality. And that's not the world of physical reality, it's another world alongside it. And I think we explore other dimensions of reality through our experiences of beauty, our moral intuitions, and of course I also want to say, our encounters with the sacred reality of God. So a big issue between science and religion, and whether they're able to have a sensible and fruitful dialogue with each other is the degree to which you're able to recognize that science doesn't tell you everything. It's been colossally successful, but which is not the whole story.
Can we talk about the mind of God? Is that language that makes sense when we talk about theology, a word like mind?
Well, theology is in a bit of a bind in knowing how to speak about God, because obviously God is, if there is a God, then God is an infinite being, quite different from finite beings like ourselves. On the other hand, as finite beings, we have to use the finite resources of language that we have at our disposal. And we use human language about God, recognizing that it's not identical. I mean, God isn't just a big invisible human being, but it's the best way of talking about God. It's stretching language in some sense, but it's stretching in the right direction. It's better to describe God, for example, as Father, because God cares about individuals and acts in individual circumstances, rather than force, like the force of gravity, which is always the same and doesn't really care what's happening. So all the time in theology, we're trying to use finite human language to describe an infinite reality. We're never going to catch God in our rational nets.
So you're saying that it's better to think of God as some sort of being?
Yes. I mean, deep theologians always qualify these things and will say that God is not a being in the sense that you and I are discrete different beings, and God's just another big invisible addition to that collection, that God is much more like the ground of being, the source of being for everything else. These are subtle, worthwhile, at times perplexing ways of qualifying theological statements. I myself believe that it's very important to retain a rich enough picture of God, that God isn't just the one who breathes fire into the equations to describe a universe, as Hawking said. I think God does that, but I think God does a great deal more than that.
Have you ever doubted God?
Oh, yes, of course. Yes. I mean, some people are given the gift of an untroubled faith, but I haven't been given that gift. I'm a cheerful person, but I'm not naturally an optimist. And sometimes I think maybe Christianity is just too good to be true. God cares. There is a destiny beyond death. Jesus was raised from the dead the first Easter day to inaugurate a life of unending joy and happiness. I mean, they're fantastic, wonderful things. Sometimes it just seems too good to be true. And when I feel like that, I sometimes say to myself, okay then, deny it. And I know that I couldn't possibly do that. I know I have a very strong negative faith, not always an unwavering positive faith, but I have a very strong negative faith. I know that I have to take my stand on his side. That's what I've committed my life to, and that's what I hold to.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask a bit about your background. You became a physicist who rose to a very eminent level in the world of theoretical physics, and then you seemed to give up all of this. You left your physics department at Cambridge, and you went to train to become an Anglican priest. Why did you make that jump?
First of all, let me say that I very much enjoy my career as a physicist. I worked in particle physics about 25 years. It was a very interesting time to be in the subject. As a community, we discovered the quark level and the structure of matter during that time. And I regarded it, in fact, as being a Christian vocation to use such talents that I had in that respect. But I was a theoretical physicist using mathematics to try and understand the physical world. And it's just a fact, and it's a fact I've seen illustrated, that you don't get better in mathematical subjects as you get older. What counts in mathematics is not accumulated experience and wisdom and that sort of thing. What counts is flexibility of mind. Unfortunately, as you get older, you lose that flexibility of mind. So after I'd been in the subject about 25 years, I felt I'd done my bit for physics. I had a chair in Cambridge. I was a senior member of a large research group with very talented young people working in the group. And I didn't want to stagger on to a time where people were saying behind my back, poor old John, you know, he's lost the lost the story. So I thought I would do something else. And rather to my surprise, the idea of seeking ordination seemed the right thing to do, and I think it was the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you to put your scientific hat back on.
Right.
Do you think there are fundamental laws of science yet to be discovered?
Yes, I do. Scientists are just beginning, in a very, very small way, to be able to study the behavior of mildly complex systems. Most of it's done by computer modeling. People like Stuart Kaufman and so on have been doing this. And the systems they study are interesting, but nowhere near as complicated as a single living cell. They find these systems have amazing self-organizing powers, that they can spontaneously produce organized, structured behavior to a very remarkable and totally unforeseeable degree. And I think that there are laws of nature, holistic laws of nature, self-organizing laws of nature, written terms not so much of energy but as information, in other words, the description of dynamical pattern, which are awaiting discovery. And I expect and hope, though I shan't live to see it, that in the 21st century those sort of laws, extra laws, will come to light. In other words, I think that the scientific story at the end of the 21st century is likely to be a great deal richer than it appears at the beginning of the century. You see, science's fundamental technique has been divide and rule. It has been reductionist because it's easier to understand bits and pieces rather than things in their totalities. But we're just beginning to see that there are some very, very significant and exciting things that you can't see simply by taking things apart.
John Polkinghorne is canon theologian at Liverpool Cathedral in England. He was a distinguished professor of mathematical physics at Cambridge University, and he's a fellow of the Royal Society. His many books include Quarks, Chaos, and Christianity. And if you want to hear more of Steve's other interviews on science and religion, visit our website at ttbook.org. I'm Anne Strainchamps, in for Jim Fleming, and you're listening to the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. What's next for physics? Quantum theory showed us that light can be both wave and particle and paved the way for laptops and cell phones and even Facebook. But we're still waiting for jetpacks, flying cars, and invisibility cloaks. What strange new physics will bring us those? The physics of the impossible, according to Michio Kaku. He's a theoretical physicist at the City University of New York, a co-founder of string field theory, a best-selling author, and a frequent host of radio and television shows. He told Jim Fleming that for physicists, impossible just means it'll take a little bit longer.
Class 1 impossibilities are things that are impossible today, but maybe possible in 10 years. For example, invisibility within a few decades. We're going to master that technology completely. Ray guns, starships, all of them fit within the Class 1 category. In fact, 90% of what you see on Star Trek is, in fact, compatible with the laws of physics. Class 2 impossibilities are much harder. They may take centuries to develop. They include warp drive, even time machines. Physicists are seriously looking at the physics of warp drive engines and time machines. And then Class 3 impossibilities are just downright impossible.
Well, let's talk about some of the examples. You say invisibility is perhaps only 10 years away. Are we playing with the word invisibility here?
We're talking true invisibility, a la H.G. Wells. It was once thought that light could not bend around an object and reform at the other end, like water. Water wraps around a boulder and reforms at the other end. Now, light doesn't work that way, but we were wrong. Every single physics textbook on the planet Earth is wrong on the question of invisibility. 2 years ago at Duke University, we did it for microwave radiation. And just a few months ago, in fact, we were filming at the University of California at Berkeley, where for the first time we did visible light and showed that on a microscopic scale, visible light can also bend backwards, making an object completely invisible. Now, this does not mean that we're going to have Harry Potter's invisibility cloak anytime soon. We're talking about microwaves, and we're talking about visible light on a very small scale. But it's only an engineering problem now to scale it up so that we can create, for example, a cylinder. A cylinder whereby if you're inside the cylinder, light hits the cylinder, wraps around the cylinder, reforms at the other end, and you are totally invisible.
As long as you're inside the cylinder.
Right. There is a problem. You cannot look outside, so you have to drill two holes in it for your eyes. So from the outside, you see two eyeballs floating in midair.
Well, how many of these things that we think of as impossible, and let's talk about some of the things that we've seen in the films, force fields, for instance. You have quite a bit in Physics of the Impossible about the possibility of force fields. We've seen them work on all of the Star Treks and Stargates and Battlestar Galacticas. But in the real world, Not so much.
Well, they're actually hard to create. We have force fields in terms of electricity, magnetism, gravity, and the nuclear force. But none of the four forces even resemble a wall that's impenetrable and invisible. So in the book, however, we go to Brookhaven National Laboratories, where some of the properties of force fields can in fact be done. In the shuttle bay of Star Trek, the air of the Enterprise separates from the vacuum of outer space by a wall of force field. We can actually do that. It's a wall of plasma, very hot gas, that is shaped just like a screen. It's invisible. You can look right through it. It's a little bit bluish in color, just like the bluish force field in Star Trek. So the force field that separates air from the vacuum of space, we've done it.
I suppose the other question that you have to have been asked 100 times, if not 1,000, is what about the power needs for things like this? The energy alone must be extraordinarily difficult.
I think you've hit on the most important thing. People ask the question, where's my jetpack? Where's my hover car? Where's my floating train, right? The answer is we can actually make jetpacks. We can make hoverboards. We can make hover trains. We make them in the laboratory. The problem is, as you correctly pointed out, a portable power pack. The solution to that problem is nano batteries. That is, batteries built on a molecular scale. Most of the energy of a battery is wasted. It's just empty space. It doesn't do anything. With nanotechnology, that is manipulating individual atoms, you can make sheets one molecule thick. And in fact, we're doing it now in the laboratory, and stack them up vertically. And that creates what is called a capacitor bank, and you can store fabulous amounts of energy in the palm of your hand. We want to create a nano battery, a super battery, and President Obama is very interested in this because we want electric cars. Gasoline, pound for pound, has more energy than any battery known to science. 100 years ago, Henry Ford and Thomas Edison had a rivalry. Who would make the first mass-produced automobile? Thomas Edison said electricity, Henry Ford said gasoline. Well, we all know who won that battle. But the same problem that bedeviled Thomas Edison bedevils us today. Batteries are not that efficient. We will solve that.
And we're still at this point talking about things that are within what you call class one impossibilities, things that you think within the next decade or two may be achieved.
That's right.
Even the microbattery.
Even the microbattery. And people sometimes ask about teleportation. That's actually a class 1/2. Let me explain. We can now teleport individual photons, particles of light, individual atoms like rubidium and cesium. They've been zapped across a room just like in Star Trek. However, we have yet to teleport a molecule. Perhaps in a decade, we'll teleport H2O, CO2. Perhaps in a few decades, we'll teleport genes and viruses and living materials may be teleported. But let's face it, Captain Kirk consists of 10 trillion cells. That's an awful lot of cells to teleport. So full teleportation may take centuries. But individual teleportation at the level of atoms, we've done it.
It's astonishing to realize that you have. On the other hand, at this point, you don't really care whether the H2O that you teleport across the room is still H2O when it arrives on the other side. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you teleport me across the room, I care very much whether I'm still there on the other side.
Right. And then the question of me is actually in doubt because you have to die and be dissolved in order for this thing to work, and then you're reformed at the other end. And then the question is, who is that man over there? You just saw this person die. Captain Kirk is dead. And this other person over there is an imposter. But it's an exact imposter. Every single memory cell is identical. The personality quirk, he says he's Captain Kirk, but you just saw him die. So the question is, who are you? Who are you if I can take your information and recreate a copy of yourself that claims to be you but is not you?
I don't want to go deeply into time because so many people have talked about it in so many ways, but there was a time when talking of time travel was something that was strictly for science fiction aficionados, if for them, in fact. H.G. Wells, of course, wrote The Time Machine years and years ago, a century ago, basically. You're talking about it now as though you think there actually will be time travel.
That's right. It seems to be compatible with the laws of physics. Stephen Hawking used to say, bah, humbug, time travel's not possible. Where are the tourists from the future? Well, he doesn't say that anymore. He's changed his mind. He says that time travel is possible. It is compatible with the laws of physics, but to build a machine would be very impractical. It's a class 2 impossibility. You're talking about the energy of a star, the energy of a black hole. We now know that black holes can twist and rip the fabric of space and time. However, it's very dangerous to go through a black hole. A black hole may be a gateway to another universe, but it's very dangerous to go through it. You have to stabilize that hole. You have to make sure it doesn't close on you. And for that, you need something called negative energy. And that's what's called all the excitement. This is what Einstein overlooked. He overlooked negative energy. Energy we think is positive. Matter has positive energy. Negative energy is less than nothing. But we now create it in the laboratory. That's the fantastic thing. Just a few days ago, I was at Harvard photographing with a film crew from the Science Channel a demonstration of negative energy right in front of my face. We play with it now. Now, the catch is, why don't we have, therefore, DeLoreans that take us back to the 1950s with Michael J. Fox? The catch is, the amount of negative energy we have today is very tiny, less than the weight of an ant. You need stellar-sized quantities of negative energy to open up a time machine. But it's an engineering problem. You know, centuries from now, our descendants may, in fact, have tremendous amounts of negative energy, in which case they will stabilize a black hole, open the gateway, and keep it open so that you can freely go back and forth.
Of course, if that's going to happen, then it probably is happening because that time must exist for them to be able to come back to this time.
That's why I say that one day if somebody knocks on your door and claims to be your great-great-great-great-great-great-great-granddaughter, don't slam the door. Maybe our descendants have created time machines and they want to meet their illustrious ancestor in the 21st century.
Michio Kaku is a theoretical physicist and co-founder of String Theory. He and Jim were talking about his most recent book, Physics of the Impossible, a scientific exploration into the world of phasers, force fields, teleportation, and time travel.
3, 2, 1.
And that's to the best of our knowledge, blasting off for today. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Jim Fleming will be back next week. If you've got questions or comments about today's show, you can email us through our website. It's at ttbook.org. We've got complete book and music listings there and a link to the podcast. And by the way, for all of you who've complained about that website, we've got a complete remodel coming soon, so just hang in there. If you want a CD copy of this hour, call the radio store. It's 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 926A, The Universe. Thanks to our hardworking staff of producers who achieve the impossible every week and make it look easy, Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, Veronica Rickert, Mary Lou Finnegan, and Leanne Ziegler. Kirill Owen, mistress of the radio space-time continuum, is our technical director. And our executive producer, the guy with a brain like a multiverse, is Steve Paulson.
PRI, Public Radio International.